good evening. The Dow Jones swings. Coronavirus causes havoc around the world. What's behind the germ? Jobs are up for now. The Mueller report, it's not done. And a swastika flag flies at a Bernie rally. The candidate's response. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Friday, March 6th, 2020. The number of people infected with coronavirus surpassed 100,000 across the world as the outbreak reached more countries and intensified economic damage. Business districts are empty and stock markets tumbling. The outbreak has killed more than 3,400 people and spread across more than 90 nations, six countries reporting their first cases on Friday. In Italy, the death toll from an outbreak rose by 49 to 197. Italy is currently reporting more deaths from the virus than any other country in the world. The government ordered the closure of schools, universities, cinemas, and theaters around the country this week to try and stem the infections. The Vatican, an independent state that sits in the heart of Rome, also registered its first case on Friday. The National Health Institute said the average age of those who had died so far in Italy was 81, with the vast majority suffering underlying health problems. Just 28% were women. The overall death rate was more than 4%. Iran's death toll from the virus jumped to 124 as more than 1,000 new cases were diagnosed over 24 hours. In the United States, 230 people have been infected in total and 12 have died. More than 2,000 people were stranded on the Grand Princess cruise ship after it was barred from returning to port in San Francisco because at least 35 people aboard developed flu-like symptoms. In New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced there were 4,000 people who had voluntarily quarantined themselves and 44 who had been ordered quarantined. There has been a shortage of testing kits in the United States since the pandemic arrived. Governments have imposed strict rules about who gets tested first.
First priority for testing is people who have been in close contact. We define close contact as within 6 feet of a person who is known to have to be positive. Second, people who have traveled to a country with level 2 or 3 travel health notice from the CDC and is experiencing symptoms. Third is a person who's in quarantine and has developed symptoms while in quarantine. Fourth, a seriously ill individual who has not tested positive for other viruses. Fifth, any other case in which, in the opinion of the healthcare professional and the local health department, they believe requires testing. We keep going back and forth between the word quarantine and isolation. Let's say they're basically synonyms, but isolation is the technical word. So it's really mandatory or directed versus what we call precautionary. Mandatory quarantine, anyone who tests positive, anyone who has been in direct contact with a person who's tested positive, anyone who's returned from a country CDC level 2 or 3 and is experiencing symptoms, any other person who their health professional and the local health department believes needs to be quarantined, and they'll speak to DOH to make that determination. That's mandatory quarantine. Precautionary quarantine, you return from a country with CDC level 2 or 3, but you are not symptomatic, okay? That's precautionary quarantine. Third, any person who the local health provider and the local health department thinks should be quarantined, and again, they'll consult with New York State Department of Health on that. We're mapping all these cases. We're analyzing them. The number of precautionary quarantines is at 4,000 statewide, 2,700 New York City, 1,000 Westchester, and then 115 Erie, 70 Nassau, Tompkins 15, Suffolk 15, Albany 11, Broome 4, Schenectady 12. Mandatory quarantines, 44 statewide, New York City 9, Westchester 33, Erie 1, Nassau 1.
Meanwhile, President Trump landed in Georgia Friday afternoon. He'd pulled out of a scheduled visit to the Centers for Disease Control, headquartered in Atlanta. Earlier in the day, he signed into law an emergency $8.3 billion spending bill. He initially said a potential case of coronavirus at CDC was the reason for dropping the trip.
So we're signing the $8.3 billion. I asked for $2.5 billion, and I got $8.3 billion, and I'll take it. So here we are, $8.3 billion. It's an unforeseen problem. What a problem. Came out of nowhere, but we're taking care of it. We have big news on the ship. A lot of things are happening on the ship. People are being tested right now. And I just spoke to the governor of California, Gavin Newsom. We had a good conversation. We're both working on the ship together. It's close to 5,000 people, so it's a big ship. We're doing testing on those people. Okay?
Mr. President, why aren't you going to CDC today? He's actually sent me. I'm going to go down.
You could tell that.
Yep.
We may go. They thought there was a problem at CDC with somebody that had the virus. It turned out negative, so we're seeing if we can do it. But yesterday afternoon, we were informed that there may have been a person with the virus, and they now find out that that was a negative test. They've tested the person very fully, and it was a negative test. So I may be going. We're going to see if they can turn it around with Secret Service.
The Trump administration initially announced that it would allocate only $2.5 billion for dealing with the possible epidemic in the United States. Meanwhile, Ronald Klain, who former President Barack Obama appointed to lead the U.S. response to the Ebola epidemic, ripped into Trump's response to the pandemic on Friday. Klain, who was dubbed the Ebola Czar, a crisis, called Trump a crisis of both confidence and competence in the way the White House was tackling the spread of the virus.
Trump administration seems to be doing everything exactly wrong. And by that, I mean the obvious things, which is having the president go out there and say things that are untrue, that fall into the categories of both misleading and deliberately unhelpful. When he told everyone to go to work with coronavirus, that is not only a bad communication, but really like a very bad communication. And what we're seeing really is, even if you accept, and I don't, that President Trump's singular goal here is trying to keep the stock market up during the coronavirus thing, him saying things that are erratic and irresponsible is actually not reassuring people, but making people more anxious. I mean, his efforts to just kind of tweet the virus away is actually making public anxiety about the virus worse, not better. So what should he do? What he should do is let the public health experts be the voice of the response. The idea that they told Dr. Tony Fauci, who served six presidents, who's probably the nation's leading, probably the world's leading infectious disease expert, that he shouldn't go on television unless some staff flunky in Mike Pence's office says it's okay, is ridiculous. The idea that they've sidelined senior officials at the Centers for Disease Control is ridiculous. That's who the public should hear from, both to get accurate information and to lower the level of anxiety about the disease and at least, you know, get it right. And so I think that's the biggest problem we have right now on the communication side. But if they don't fix the competence problems, all the confidence problems will just get worse and worse.
Since becoming president, Trump has gutted the U.S. infectious disease infrastructure, forced out key leaders, and tried unsuccessfully to cut the budget of the CDC. The president has been downgrading the potential threat of the coronavirus. He's ordered government experts such as Dr. Anthony Fauci to clear any statements with the White House before going public. Meanwhile, people in Chicago and New York have been avoiding restaurants for no logical reason. An associate professor of biology at the College of William and Mary is Kurt Williamson. He explains what makes a virus tick and why the coronavirus is so dangerous.
Viruses are acellular parasites, so they use cells and organisms made out of cells to make more of themselves. Outside of a cell, they don't do much. What is a coronavirus? So viruses as a group is very broad and diverse. And so coronavirus is one subcategory of viruses in the breadth of what viruses are. So there are viruses that infect bacteria. There are viruses that infect fungi. There are viruses that infect animals. And then within animals, you know, there are viruses that infect humans. There are viruses that infect dogs, horses, et cetera. Coronavirus is just a grouping of genetically related viruses.
And then what happens? It takes over the cell and destroys it, right?
Pretty much. The destruction is sort of like a side effect for most viruses. Like, the cell is so overtaken with performing viral functions that it's not seeing to its own maintenance.
Why is this different from the flu and other bugs that we get?
A lot of scientists are still waiting to see exactly what is different about this. There's kind of two main ingredients that make virus A more of a problem than virus B. One is, what kind of cells can it get into? This is a problem with, say, the Ebola virus. It can get into many different kinds of cells in our body. So different organ systems, different tissues are all being affected at the same time. And so it's kind of a system overload. For this coronavirus, I think part of it is the tissues that it targets. It also seems to go to the lungs. And so that is a sensitive target in that it, if it impacts the breathing too much, the host, which is us, really suffers. The second component then of how serious the virus is how much of an immune response does it stimulate? A lot of what we sort of look at as virus symptoms, a lot of it is just our immune response. So influenza really does a good job at almost overstimulating the immune response. So you feel a lot of times headache, joint pain, you know, inflammation. People describe sort of like this being hit by a train. You know, that is essentially flu triggering an immune response, and it's that immune response that makes you just feel so crummy. Most of the cases that have resulted in death, there's some sort of other underlying problem. So it makes, like, once you have the virus causing damage and amplifying an immune system on top of that condition, it really, again, ends up in sort of a system overload. More people who recover are dealing just with the virus without other complicating factors.
Older people are the target, or seem to be the most susceptible.
It's constantly changing picture, and so until all the data are in, we won't know for sure exactly why this strain of coronavirus is more of a problem than, say, other circulating strains that are already in the human population.
Is testing important, and why is that important?
Yes, testing is important. In order for all medical professionals, I mean, if you put this outside of this COVID-19 outbreak, the treatment that they're going to give hinges on their diagnosis. And a problem with many respiratory diseases, including, you know, influenza, which is viral in nature, versus, say, a bacterial pneumonia, a lot of viruses present with the same kinds of symptoms, especially initially. So headache, fever, rash, soreness, feeling run down. Just based on that clinical diagnosis, it's hard for medical professionals to say, well, what is it really?
Why does it take so long to get a vaccine for this?
Part of it is we have to identify what is a good target. So when most vaccines, they're built on the idea that you're exposing the person to some physical component of the virus, some protein, right? Some surface, what we would call an antigen. And that's going to stimulate an immune response, primarily the production of antibodies. Mm-hmm. That part, I think there's some pretty good work happening. And also based on what is already known about other coronaviruses, we can do this relatively rapidly, probably in a matter of months. A lot of the time it takes up is safety testing. Vaccines are one of the most heavily tested and highly regulated products that are out there on the market, in spite of public perception about them not being safe. Most estimates that I'm seeing, reasonable estimates, are likely about 18 months.
Do we know if we could get this again if you get it once? Is it one of those things where like the mumps where you never get it again, or could you get this over and over again,
yeah,
like a cold?
Again, this is a question I think everyone, medical and epidemiology, et cetera, is waiting to see. What's the difference between coronavirus and flu? They are in different classes, so they're not identical. And part of that is, like, a flu vaccine will not protect you from coronavirus. But they do have a similarity in that both of them, the genomic material is not DNA, it's RNA. So for us, our genomes are made out of DNA. Theirs are made out of RNA, and so they use a virus-encoded enzyme that copies that RNA into other RNA. And that enzyme makes mistakes. So the flu virus is constantly cranking out new variants of itself. So this is possible. This is possible with the coronavirus because its replication is going to suffer from the same problem. uses the same kind of enzyme to copy its RNA genome. And so it has the potential to crank out variation just as flu does. But again, since it's just emerged in the human population, I think everyone, again, everyone involved in response to the outbreak is kind of keeping an eye on this, waiting to see what happens.
Kurt Williamson is an associate professor of biology at the College of William and Mary. Join me tomorrow on WBAI at noon on WBAI for a special program on the coronavirus outbreak. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A federal judge on Thursday sharply criticized Attorney General William Barr's handling of the report by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Judge Reggie B. Walton said Barr could not be trusted, saying the attorney general presented a distorted and misleading account of its findings. Walton ruled that Barr's lack of candor called into question his credibility. He ordered the Department of Justice privately show him the portions of the report that were censored in the publicly released version. Barr's public rollout of the Mueller report has been highly criticized. The lawsuit centers on freedom of information requests by the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, and by Jason Leopold, a BuzzFeed News reporter. The general counsel for EPIC is Alan Butler.
The purpose of the suit was to obtain this public disclosure of the complete Mueller report. And at the time we filed the suit last year, it was announced that the Mueller investigation had been finalized, that there was a report that had been submitted to the Attorney General and would be submitted to Congress, and the public did not have access to that report. During the course of our lawsuit, the Attorney General disclosed a redacted version of that report to the public, but before he did so, he made a number of public statements, including submitting letters to Congress and holding a press conference where he characterized the report, and it turned out after the redacted report was released, he mischaracterized that report. But nevertheless, we continue to pursue through our litigation the release of the full report under the Freedom of Information Act. And so at this point, the government has made arguments in support of its withholding of material in the Mueller report, and EPIC is challenging the government's decision to withhold that material.
And what was the decision?
The decision issued yesterday by Judge Walton in the Federal District Court in D.C. was that the judge decided to review the entire report in camera to determine whether the material, additional material, can be released. The Department of Justice had argued that all the redacted material should be withheld, and EPIC argued both that that material should be released and that the judge should review the material independently, in particular because of the Attorney General's statements about the report, his handling of the rollout of the report, and how that essentially tainted the Department of Justice process. And the judge agreed. He made clear that the Attorney General's handling of the Mueller report release raised substantial concerns about the DOJ's independence, and that in these circumstances, the representations of the Justice Department about those redactions are not sufficient. That's why the judge has to conduct his own independent assessment to see whether DOJ complied with the Freedom of Information Act.
How much is actually missing? It seemed like it was just a small amount. Is it really what was missing from the redacted, which means edited, version? Is that really of any import, do you think?
The material in the Mueller report, including the redacted material, is all significant. It's not about the volume of what was redacted or what was not redacted. It's about the significance of the information.
What do you think that information is? Do you have any idea what it might be?
Well, the report has a pretty clear structure to it. So when you look at the report, and I encourage people to do so, we have a version available to the public that's in EPIC's bookstore, and you can also find it online. So you can tell from the report that when there are, for example, entire pages blacked out, you know that those pages are within the section that talks about disinformation efforts that disrupted the election or hacking efforts that disrupted the election and led to further crimes and exposures, or that certain redacted material relates to potential obstruction of justice.
What goes next? What happens next?
What is going to happen next is the Department of Justice is going to submit the full unredacted report to the judge, who will review the redacted material, and he will issue a final decision in the next few months, hopefully as quickly as possible, deciding what more can be released.
This could lead to it being released to you and then to the public.
It will be, yes, it will be released to EPIC and the public.
Alan Butler is general counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. A former prosecutor who handled drug and street crime cases, Judge Walton is known for handing down tough sentences and for being careful and methodical. He also once broke up a street brawl near the courthouse. And in campaign news, a man was kicked out of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' rally in Arizona after he unfurled a Nazi flag during the Democratic presidential candidate's speech.
Let me thank all of you for coming out tonight. Let me thank the Red...
Sanders' supporters appeared to rip the flag from the protesters' hands, and police escorted him out. Speaking on Friday, Sanders addressed the incident.
I will simply say this, and I speak not only as a Jewish American, I think I can speak for the families of some 400,000 American troops who died fighting Nazism, fighting fascism, that it is horrific. It is beyond disgusting to see that in the United States of America, there are people who would show the emblem of Hitler and Nazism. And I was shocked to learn about that later. Now, we have had, and I know some of you have been with me, we have had other events with some Trump people. You know, they got over agitated and they try to disrupt the meeting. You know, we deal with that. But this was something different. To have in the United States of America somebody bringing forth the most detestable symbol in modern history, a symbol of which over 400,000 brave Americans died trying to defeat, is unspeakable. Unspeakable.
The incident has raised concerns for the safety of presidential candidates. Meanwhile, two key Democratic primaries are on tap for next Tuesday, March 10th, in Michigan and Idaho. The polling aggregator 538.com has former Vice President Joe Biden leading in Michigan with 38% of the vote against Senator Bernie Sanders with 30% of the vote. In a state that surprisingly went for Trump in 2016, Michigan is widely considered a much win for Sanders. Meanwhile, a Colorado conservative congressman, Ken Buck, tweeted a video on Friday showing himself holding an AR-15 rifle and making threatening remarks towards former Vice President Biden and former Representative Beto O'Rourke.
Message for Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke. If you want to take everyone's AR-15 in America, why don't you swing by my office in Washington, D.C. and start with this one. Come and take it.
Buck's threats come less than a week after O'Rourke endorsed Biden's 2020 presidential bid at a campaign rally. At that rally, Biden told O'Rourke, "You're going to take care of this gun problem with me. You're going to be the one who leads the effort." The rifle Buck held in his video on Friday is notably inoperable. In a 2015 interview with the Washington Post, Buck said that he removed the bolt carrier assembly, a necessary component to fire the weapon, and installed a trigger lock on it. And March 8th is International Women's Day, a national holiday in 27 countries, including Russia and China, a non-official holiday in other countries, but not in the United States. Despite being left out of from official recognition, women all over the country will be marking the weekend with rallies, marches, and educational events. In New York, the Women's Press Collective will be holding an event in Brooklyn on Saturday. The operations manager for Women's Press Collective is Lisa Daniel.
On this coming Saturday, March 7th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., Women's Press Collective will be celebrating International Women's Day. And our theme this year is called Telling the Truth in a Climate of Disinformation. And this is a very important theme, and it is, in fact, best describes what Women's Press Collective is fighting to change and the work that we must be doing at this time. According to a poll by the Columbia Journalism Review, 70% of U.S. adults think that some or most of the news they consume is disinformation. And what is disinformation? The Webster's Dictionary definition is false information designed to confuse or mislead, leaked to an antagonist. So it's a very important theme that we'll be discussing at the event. But our event is also a celebration, and it's to celebrate particularly women's leadership in building truly independent media that can tell the truth. So we have some fabulous performers, song, dance performances. There's a wonderful lunch that's been prepared by our volunteers, and we welcome all of your listeners to join us. The event will be Saturday, March 7th, tomorrow, starting at 11 a.m. and going till 3 p.m., And the event is being hosted by the Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. The address is 85 South Oxford Street, and that's between Lafayette and Fulton. And we welcome everybody to come.
What exactly is International Women's Day?
International Women's Day is a celebration that is officially celebrated in over 100 countries worldwide, although not in this one officially, not in the United States. And it is a holiday that was founded to honor working women. And the inspiration for the holiday was, in fact, the militant action of women, low-paid women workers here in New York City, who on March 8, 1908, marched through the streets of Lower Manhattan, 15,000 women, most of whom worked in the sweatshops of Lower Manhattan at that time, and they marched to demand shorter working hours, higher pay, an end to child labor, women's suffrage. And it was in recognition of the militancy of women workers here that the international holiday was established.
And why isn't it officially followed in the United States?
Partly it is because it is to honor working women. And also the holiday was called for through a socialist conference held in Copenhagen in Denmark in 1910, 2 years after the action by the women in New York City. So that genesis may be something that the government here doesn't want to recognize. That would be my guess.
What is the importance of marking International Women's Day, and what does it mean for people today?
International Women's Day is an important holiday because it is firmly grounded in the necessity of the leadership of working women, women in our country who do the work that makes this country work, women who are doing the food preparation, the farm work, making the clothes, doing the domestic care work, the women who make this country work and our leadership. Our membership here at Women's Press Collective also includes many women who work in the trades, who build buildings, who do the plumbing, who do the electrical work. And it's our leadership having the opportunity to advance.
And finally, the 2020 South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas has been canceled due to concerns over COVID-19 coronavirus. The Music, Film, and Interactive Technology Conference was scheduled to run from March 13th to 22nd. This is the first time in its 34-year existence that it's canceled. It is the largest annual economic event, and for Austin, the largest U.S. tech hub outside of Silicon Valley. And that's some of the news for Friday, March 6, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Be sure to join us, if you can, tomorrow at noon Saturday for our special on the coronavirus outbreak here on WBAI.